Hello, everyone. Welcome to session 265. We're going to get started here. Heartthrob, the Need for Heavenly Mother and Latter-day Saint Theology. My name is Chelsea Archibald. I will be the chair for this session. And if we have enough time at the end, we will facilitate some questions. Just a reminder to silence your cell phones. And we'll introduce our awesome speakers here. Rachel Hunt Steenblick is a PhD student in philosophy of religion and theology at Claremont Graduate University. She has a master's in library science from Simmons College in Boston, Massachusetts, and a bachelor's in philosophy from BYU in Provo, Utah. She was one of the primary researchers on the BYU Studies article, A Mother There, A Survey of Historical Teachings About Mother in Heaven. Further research interests include Kierkegaard, Levinas, and feminist theology. And she's expecting her first baby in October, which is a baby girl. Do Daughtry has a PhD in religious studies and teaches classes in religion and popular culture, womb, and religion, and witchcraft and heresy in Europe. She is a video game Comic-Con and role-playing fanatic. Her latest academic interest is in how the gendered experience of those activities relate to religion and inform personal identity.
Please let me know if the microphone works or if you can hear me. Okay. On November
15th,
no,
we can't hear
it. Take it off if you want. Does that make it difficult?
Can you hear me now? Is this better?
Do you want me to hold it for you while you're
reading? Well, I can hold it. I'm having trouble getting it out. Okay, how about now? Okay. On November 15, 1845, a poem was published in a small newspaper in Nauvoo, Illinois. The poem was not like other poems, and the paper was not like other papers. Both were for people striving to create safe and sacred spaces in a world that had become increasingly hostile. The poem was titled Invocation or to the Eternal Father and Mother. The paper is Times and Seasons, the People are Members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, also known as Mormons. And the poetess was a woman named Eliza R. Snow. Her poem, Written as a Prayer, was set to music, published in Elliott's Hymnal in 1851. Now known as Oh My Father, has become one of the Latter-day Saints' most beloved hymns. Besides affirming belief in a Heavenly Mother, it sets out core Lori Mormon beliefs and the literal paternity of God the Father in the pre-mortal birth and existence of each member of the human family. LDS theologian B.H. Roberts referred to Eliza's poem as that splendid hymn of ours on Heavenly Motherhood, the great throbbing hunger of woman's souls. I quote it here in its entirety. O my Father, thou that dwellest in a high and glorious place, when shall I regain thy presence and again behold thy face? In thy holy habitation did my spirit once reside, in my first primeval childhood was I nurtured near thy side. For a wise and glorious purpose, thou hast placed me here on earth, and withheld the recollection of my former friends and birth. Yet oft times a secret something whispered, you're a stranger here, and I felt that I had wandered from a more exalted sphere. I had learned to call thee Father through thy spirit from on high, but until the key of knowledge was restored, I knew not why. And the heavens, our parents still know the thought makes reason stare. Truth is reason, truth eternal, tells me I have a mother there. When I leave this frail existence, when I lay this mortal by, Father, Mother, may I meet you in your mortal courts on high. And at length, when I have completed all you send me forth to do, with your mutual approbation, let me come and dwell with you. While over 160 years have passed, many women's and men's souls continue to throb with hunger. In this brief presentation, I suggest that Latter-day Saints are not the only ones who are hungry, that their hunger is particularly acute. I postulate the need for divine female being, both in feminist and Latter-day Saint theologies. I also share particular expressions of this need and remark on whether or not this hunger can be filled. The necessity for a divine feminine is not unique to the Mormon faith. Indeed, feminist theology possesses a wellspring of clear and rich expressions articulating this need. And beyond God the Father, feminist Mary Daly pointedly lays out the problem. If God is male, then male is God. She is joined in her conviction by Carol P. Crist, Rosemary Radford Ruther, and others. Crist's off-published article, Why Women Need the Goddess, addresses this need directly. Systems focused around exclusively male images of divinity create the impression that female power can never be fully legitimate or wholly beneficent. A woman may see herself like God, created in the image of God, only by denying her own sexual identity and affirming God's transcendence of sexual identity. She can never have the experience that is freely available to every man and boy in her culture of having her full sexual identity affirmed as being in the image and likeness of God. Alternately, envisioning God as female affirms the female body and life cycle, including their unique position as menstruants, birth givers, and those who have traditionally cared for the young and the dying, which roles may provide women's lives and bodies with much deserved reverence. In a direct dialogue with Mormon theology, Luther engages in a critique of patriarchal images and concepts of God, as well as in a re-envisioning of God language inclusive of women and men. After clarifying that language for God that subordinates women is detrimental to men as well, she asked, what then has been the problem with images of God we have inherited? Possibly hearkening back to Daly, Luther answers that feminist critique is focused on the idea that God is imaged as male, and so only men can represent God. Even if the maleness of God is not taken in a literal biological sense, nevertheless, godlikeness is expressed in activities that men can do, but women cannot. Moreover, any inclination to assume that women's bodies are extensions of men's thoroughly denies women's autonomous personhood. It also makes clear that mythology rejects the appropriateness of imaging God as female. At the same time, it denies that women are in the image of God. When a theology rejects God as female, females are effectively, if not explicitly, forgotten, thus proffering a strong case for divine feminine in language as well as in life. In her article, Jesus Our Mother, Mormon feminist Jenna Solred echoed, if there are any who think the gender of the real God is insignificant, let them ask themselves, what if Jesus had been a woman? What if the scriptures talked predominantly about God the Mother? What difference would that make in my ideas about God, about myself, and how would that affect my experience with deity? While this need for a female deity is widespread, it becomes particularly pressing in LDS Church, which views God as an embodied male and gender as an eternal characteristic. Many, if not most, other religions view God as an unembodied amorphous being. Therefore, even when male pronouns are employed, actual masculinity, i.e. male genitalia, is neither inferred nor envisioned. Addressing these same difficulties, Ruther notes that Mormons assume that God is father and mother and bears an eternally fixed role and family pattern, and that this gender division in God that founds that division among humans is to be taken literally. God really is flesh and bone, male human being, writ large, divine, and immortal. This LDS view diverges not only from Ruther's as a feminist theologian, but also from the mainstream Christian tradition. Although the mainline Christian tradition has used mostly male names for God, is understood these as metaphors, not as little references to a flesh and bone male. Ruther finds more appealing those who are trying to reclaim Mormonism's liberating promise for women. They see particularly positive promise in its view of the divine embodied in both male and female form as such a liberating tradition. These individuals wish to free the female embodiment of the divine from her shadows binding male gods so that both can stand together as partners, and as models for the partnership of men and women in church, family, and society, growing together into the divine and immortal promise. She calls for Latter-day Saints to openly proclaim an equal Heavenly Father and Mother. And the Lord is a role model for men and women. Ida Smith describes Joseph Smith as one of those who least partially answers Ruther's call. Quote, when newly restored truth of the prophet taught hard for the world to swallow in his day, and still misinterpreted by many in our own time, was the Lord's view of woman. The prophet taught that men and women are of equal value and of equal importance in the sight of God. He preached that in order for a man to achieve his highest potential of the celestial kingdom and godhood, he must have a woman equally exalted by his side and sealed him forever. A just God would not require the linking of two unequal beings for eternity. Building upon the foundation laid by Joseph Smith, subsequent prophets taught that God was not single, but married, that there is a Heavenly Father and a Heavenly Mother, and that we were made in their image, male and female children. Such an exalted role for a woman was mind-boggling for 19th century America. End quote. It is actually concerned with whom the LDS doctrine of Heavenly Mother originated. Some individuals believe it began with Eliza, including President Gordon B. Hinckley. Quote, it was Eliza R. Snow who wrote the words, truth is reason, truth eternal tells me I, the mother, there. End quote. Or actually, sorry, not quote. It has been said that the prophet Joseph Smith made no corrections to what Sister Snow had written, therefore we have a mother in heaven. Many others believe it was first revealed to and through Brother Joseph, the first LDS prophet. Later, Church President Joseph F. Smith stated, the Eliza R. Snow poem appeared in 1845 and caused no great stir because the doctrine was not an alien one. Historical information seems to indicate that the concept originated with the prophet Joseph Smith and was spelled out in poetic form by the creative Snow. While it is known that an earlier Mormon hymn also spoke of Heavenly Mother, there does seem to be secondary support for Joseph F. Smith's foremost claim. Brigham Young's daughter, Susa Young Gates, related that after Zina Huntington's mother passed away in 1839, Joseph Smith offered condolences before adding, and you will meet and become acquainted with your eternal mother, the wife of your father in heaven. We have an additional account related by Zebedee Colchin. He wrote, one day the prophet Joseph asked him and Sidney Rigdon to accompany him into the woods to pray. When they reached a secluded spot, Joseph lay down on his back and stretched out his arms. He told the brethren to lie on each arm and then shut their eyes. After they had prayed, he told them to open their eyes. They did so and saw brilliant light surrounding a pedestal which seemed to rest on the earth. They closed their eyes and prayed again. Then they saw, on opening them, the Father seated upon a throne. They prayed again and on looking saw the Mother also. After praying and looking the fourth time, they saw the Savior added to the group. Still, Joseph Smith may only partially answer Luther's challenge, for he did teach early adopters about Heavenly Mother. He did not see fit to leave subsequent saints, either records or scriptures directly concerning her, as he did for other newly revealed doctrines, nor did he flesh her out literally or figuratively, as he did God the Father and Jesus Christ the Son. This omission has had long-standing implications, for while doctrine concerning Heavenly Mother is implicitly present, and LDS theology and scriptures and quasi-canonical proclamations, as well as explicitly in a small number of hymns, plus the memos and statements by church authorities, is still not often emphasized. We do know, however, that Joseph Smith taught early LDS adherents that it is the first principle of the gospel to know for a certainty the character of God. And if men do not understand the character of God, they do not understand themselves. This poses a potentially difficult problem for LDS women. If they do not understand the character of God as to know, do they understand themselves? More significantly, if life eternal is to know the only true God, as John 17:3 states, is their salvation at stake? The great throbbing hunger of women's souls concerning heavenly motherhood becomes no small thing. Latter-day Saints' hunger for a divine feminine frequently finds expression on LDS blogs, known together as the blogger network. There are many possible reasons for this. One is that community members view these spaces as safe havens to write and discuss matters that they may not feel comfortable or think are possible to address elsewhere, including in Sunday school classes or with some others of their faith. There are fairly good historical reasons for individuals to feel apprehension. In the early 1990s, President Gordon B. Hinckley, not yet the prophet but already a general authority, gave a talk entitled Daughters of God, denouncing those who pray to Heavenly Mother as well-meaning but misguided. There was also a series of ecclesiastical reprimands, and even excommunications stemming at least in part from individuals' writings or practices concerning Heavenly Mother. Joanna Brooks' memoir, Book of Mormon Girl, contains a moving section on being a Mormon feminist at Brigham Young University during that time. She watched as Mormon women gathered together to tentatively, if sometimes clumsily, parse the grammar of Mormon feminism. All are alike unto God. God is a mother and a father. Mormon women matter. She watched as her mentors left their professorships at BYU one by one, sometimes by choice, sometimes by the request of the university. She watched as the church she was born into and deeply cherished declared her a double enemy for being a feminist and intellectual. She watched herself hand back her diploma as a form of protest and when she went into a kind of exile. There were others like her across the country. Some chose to stop talking about their feelings and ideas altogether, attain peaceful relationships with family or ward members. Some left lives of womanism. So others hung on while hiding out. Brooks explained, we gathered by the rivers of the internet and laughed and wept when we remembered Zion. From Boise, Mesa, Los Angeles, from Boston and Philadelphia, we led the whole series of excommunications and firings. She would speak of them in a school again at Claremont Graduate University in 2011 at a conference exploring the relationship between Mormonism and the Internet at the Utah Valley University in 2012. At Claremont, she called the Internet a game changer and spoke of the World Wide Web as a safety net. There are more than 6 people now. Writing and thinking about feminist and intellectual issues, it is neither likely nor possible for the church to sanction all of them. Caroline Klein, co-founder of the Exponent blog, shares similar sentiments. She has spoken passionately about how she does not feel the fear that some other Mormon feminists have experienced, in large part because of the internet. Blogs are by nature more ephemeral than books. Something is written and read to be removed from the forefront by something newer. People may also write anonymously, creating greater freedom. For many of them, the blogger knuckle offers not only a haven, but a forum for genuine speech and reception of genuine speech. Those who are hungry are allowed to ask questions and express their hunger in authentic ways. Other hungry souls read their words and learn that they are not alone in their longing. They too can chime in, adding their voice and personal experiences. At the blogger knuckle's best, original posters and commenters may be edified and rejoice together. At a second best, they may be edified and mourn together. After two posts, each harboring in their own way. The first was published on October 26, 2011, on the Exponent blog by Primal blogger Worldman. The post is accompanied by a picture of a mother with her back toward us, holding the child in her arms. The young daughter's face just barely peeks out from over the mother's shoulder. It is striking. More striking still is the post's simple beginning, which takes the form of a letter to a mother. Dear Mom, it was hard growing up without you. I love Dad and he's really good at a lot of stuff, but it wasn't the same as having a mother. I knew you were out there somewhere, but I couldn't talk to you. I couldn't get advice, I couldn't see what I was going to look like when I got older, and what a lady is really like. I only knew what Dad said they were like, and I never seemed to live much to his flawless descriptions of selfless, compassionate, spiritual woman. I don't really know anything about you. I don't know what you do or who you are. I don't know if you're powerful and strong or submissive and weak. I don't even know if you remember or even care about me. All Dad will say is that you exist and that I'm not supposed to talk about you. I don't know what that means. My brother said it's because you're so fragile that if we talked about you and said something, it would be bad. It used to make sense to me. I just accepted it as normal. I mean, I didn't know anything different. But I just had my first baby, a daughter. She's the greatest thing my whole life. When she laughs, I feel like my heart is skydiving. When she cries, I feel like my heart is breaking. I would do anything for this child. I have given up large parts of my body, my career, my love life, my time, energy, and self for this little girl, and I would do it again over and over. But I would never abandon her. I would never leave her. I would never willingly choose to be in communication with her or ignore her during her difficult moments. The time when she is begging for a mom. Then Woman repeats, it was hard growing up without you. I needed a mom to teach me about boys, sex, modesty, my body, heartbreak, hormones, friendships, love, death, and life. I needed a mom to help me through my pregnancy, labor, birth, nursing, and all the sleepless nights and hair-pulling days. No matter how thoughtful Dad was, he could never come close to understanding this stuff. He could never understand what it feels like to belong to a family where the women are silent and the men make decisions. Where femininity is a caricature of personhood, where no matter where I go, what I do, or who I talk to, I'm a girl first and a person second. I'm a mother now. What used to suffice now stinks. I don't care any longer what excuses people have made for you. You should have been here. You should have cared. You should have helped me in my difficult moments and taught me how to be a sister, daughter, mother, friend, aunt, cousin, wife, grandma, and woman. You should have helped me the things that Dad and brothers didn't understand. You should not have abandoned me. I will never do that to my daughter. I will do anything it takes to keep her safe, to protect her, to support her, to encourage her, to help her, to teach her, to love her, anything. There are no excuses that satisfy my heart of why you are absent from my life. The letter is signed, sincerely, your heavenly daughter. Woman adds the following note. I used to blame church patriarchy for the absence of Heavenly Mother and LDS doctrine rhetoric, and I realized that I'm treating her exactly like I don't want to be treated, as silent support staff for the real work of men. I treat her like a god, like someone with power, position, priestesshood, the new feelings emerge. I feel angry, I feel sad, I feel abandoned and confused. She then asks commenters to share their personal feelings regarding Heavenly Mother. Why did they think she hasn't made their presence known more? which is a God, why can't she push past the precepts of man and become an active part in the lives of her children? Have they ever had an experience with Heavenly Mother? Does she even exist? 57 people responded. The second post is a deeply personal piece published recently by common consent by guest blogger Liz Johnson. She writes, on an otherwise ordinary night in the middle of November, Johnson gave birth to a perfect but still baby girl. She is only 16 weeks pregnant. Wishing but unable to put the exact feeling of the experience into words, she writes, I know for sure that I felt my heart literally break, almost as if a piece of it had fallen off, never to be retrieved. I was brutally shaken, unable to logically figure out why this had happened. I'd felt tiny flutters just hours before, but included in the shock and grief was an overwhelming presence of something absolutely holy. It was simultaneously the most horrific and spiritual event of my life. In the days and weeks and months and years that followed, Johnson found herself praying more sincerely and openly than ever. Beautifully and mercifully, she received answers to some of her deepest questions. And felt an enveloping sense of peace and reassurance that her Heavenly Father loved her. Notwithstanding those heart-wrenching communions with deity, Johnson grasped desperately for something more. She believed that both Heavenly Father and Jesus Christ knew her and loved her infinitely, but it was no longer enough. When you experience something like this, something so uniquely female, leaves you grasping for somebody who really knows you, who really knows your pain. I believe that Christ suffered for the pains and sins of the world, but could you really truly understand the visceral pain that comes from delivering your partially formed daughter into the palms of your own hands? I mean, really? I had always believed in eternal parents. It's such a beautiful and, in my opinion, foundational piece of the gospel. But I never really thought about a Heavenly Mother more than simply reiterating what I'd always been taught, that we just don't know much about it, so we don't talk about it either. But after the otherwise ordinary night in November, those platitudes were not only insufficient, they were borderline offensive. And so since then, I found myself reaching for her. I listened to Liza Arsenault's powerful words over and over, telling me that I have a mother there. I prayed to feel her presence and her comfort and her reassurance that I am loved and understood. I am desperate to know her, to crawl up on her lap and cry like I would with my own mother. And while I wouldn't say that I reached the place I'd like to be, I briefly felt small whispers, like those a child would hear from their mother while lying on her lap, letting me know that everything will be okay and that she does indeed understand. Truly, I have a mother there. While a very small percentage of commenters believe Johnson to be going beyond the pale and reaching for a Heavenly Mother, most of the 82 commenters expressed gratitude for this beautiful post before or after expressing their own need for Divine Feminine. One female commenter wrote, "Thank you, Liz. The primal longing for mother is that made me human." Another affirms, "Wanting a Heavenly Mother is such a basic desire. Just because we don't talk about her doesn't mean that she stops existing. I see her reaching for us and quite possibly wondering why we have put so many artificial barriers between ourselves and her." Others mention the comforting nature of Heavenly Mother doctrine. I'm willing to testify, knowing that Heavenly Mother exists has always brought me comfort and peace. I wish we talked about her with the same frequency and reverence we used to talk about Heavenly Father. Some highlighted the problem mentioned previously, that if women do not understand the character of God, they do not understand themselves. One commenter explained, "As a woman, I think it is important to know more about her, especially to get an idea of what my eternity will look like. Of course, we don't know everything. We know the universe is bigger than any of us can comprehend, but we still have a greater understanding of what awaits a man who is true and faithful to his covenants." Several men offered their sympathy. One wrote, "Sometimes I forget how easy it is to be a man. It's so easy to lose sight of the fact that we have a heavenly male role model, Lord and friend, who's fully fleshed out, literally, and another heavenly male role model and father figure who also is very well fleshed out. While the women in our lives have only an obscure image, that image is better than nothing, better than no explicit acknowledgement that divinity also is female." Both of the two posts cited above convey wrenching hunger for an eternal mother, but do so in very different ways with very different tones. I offer both to show a spectrum of this need. On one hand, there is woman's raw, passionate yearning that is seemingly left unsatisfied. Like other Mormons, she had previously accepted the widely held folk doctrine that Heavenly Mother is too sacred to talk about, which historians have demonstrated did not originate from a prophet, apostle, or other general authority. But following the birth of her own daughter, woman was no longer able to accept Heavenly Mother's imposed fragility as an adequate reason for silence. She may have come to feel with Margaret Toscano that as a mother, she wanted her child to communicate with her, even if the child was angry, or that, quote, while some regard the need for silence about the Heavenly Mother as reverence, absolute silence about her does not protect her, erases her, end quote. On the other hand, there is Liz Johnson's anguish reaching that has begun to be filled, her original postnage of quiet whispers to Heavenly Mother, and a subsequent comment described her feeling that divine female's presence and the holiness of her life's most horrific sacred event. As noted, many commenters share personal yearnings for divine feminine within the constructs of LDS theology, as well as moments when they have been comforted by their belief in the Heavenly Mother or even felt her near. While wholly sympathetic to woman's desire for richer involvement of Heavenly Mother, I also affirm with Johnson and others that the LDS conception of Heavenly Mother does have some nourishing effects. Unfortunately, I do not have time to elaborate as much as I'd like, and mainly intimate that there is some evidence that at least a few individuals' hungry, throbbing souls are beginning to be satisfied. And this is a part where I try to list a few of these good things about Heavenly Mother doctrine, and I'll elaborate on the tiny number of them. First, this doctrine allows women to see themselves and their bodies as God. One former prophet, President Spencer W. Kimball, reminded women, "You are daughters of God. You are made in the image of our Heavenly Mother." Second, it means that in LDS theology, women are not entirely forgotten. Third, it suggests that there is the glorified, exalted female co-equal with God the Father, where the impossible doubts that women may also attain the highest blessings, which the glorified, exalted, and co-equal part description is taken nearly word for word from the church manual, which upon discovering made me want to shout hallelujah. Fourth, it offers hints of divine role model for women. Patricia T. Holland, who is the wife of Elder Holland, once shared her beliefs on this point with other LDS women. Saying, "I believe we know much more about our eternal nature than we think we do. It is our sacred obligation to express our knowledge, to teach it to our young sisters and daughters. All of us are Eve's daughters, whether we are married or single, maternal or barren. We are created in the image of gods to become gods and goddesses. And we can provide something with that divine pattern, that eternal prototype, for each other and for those who come after us." But admittedly, this hand may not be quite enough for many others. Fifth, LDS doctrine concerning Heavenly Mother has endowed pregnancy and motherhood with great importance for many. Some of these manifestations are found in a book or study by Angela Asher's McKee. Her interview with Latter-day Saint women regarding their personal pregnancy stories. One interviewee named Ellen said, "Mormon doctrine enhanced motherhood by adding a celestial element, by providing both the model of Heavenly Mother and expectation of eternal families." Asher's McKee was also 8 months pregnant with her first child at the time that she did this book or study. And she detailed her own feelings records. "In the past few months, I have joined this group of women for whom Mormon doctrine enhances pregnancy. For me, the doctrines about the origin of souls and the eternal future of families justify my feelings about pregnancy and motherhood. Mormon doctrine adds to this natural wonder, creating my belief that this child is a gift from heavenly parents." Sixth, as already a little bit alluded to, it may provide some general comfort. Seventh, multiple men have also gone on record expressing the existential appeal of this doctrine for them personally. One of them is David Paulson, who has done a little bit of work on Heavenly Mother. He explained that the divine feminine has for him personally made eschaton all the more inviting and exciting. Another man, in a personal conversation, reminded me that Mormon males may also feel whole in their theology and relationship with this being before asking, "Cannot sons long for their mothers?" Like Eliza R. Snow before them, today's throbbing souled, hungry strangers on earth are still trying to carve out safe and sacred spaces with which to write, speak, and for some to pray to their eternal mother. I suggest that because of the internet, world wide web, its exhaustible array of electronic reapers, blogs, databases, groups, and forums, as well as places like Sunstone, those who hunger after righteousness have increasing opportunity to have their needs fulfilled. Thank you.
Anymore. Rachel has done a really good job of illustrating the ways in which a need for Heavenly Mother gets expressed on the internet and has remarked on whether or not this need can be filled. Her point is very well taken that in most Christianities, God is not the God most generational Mormons envision when they invoke his name. And perhaps this even adds more weight to the millstone around the necks of women who agitate for women's ordination in the LDS Church. That maleness of God's body and that literal body with male genitalia, it just adds more stones around the neck. And it's precisely because our God and goddess have bodies that can show up in space and time that Ruther's call for Mormons to, quote, openly proclaim an equal Heavenly Mother and Father is so simultaneously acute and problematic. Just what does equal mean? Given that the LDS Church seems radically committed to the idea that men and women are essentially different and therefore incapable of divine job sharing, just how might we imagine a Heavenly Mother who is equal to our Heavenly Father? As Rachel has shown, we do it by seizing the day, and we imagine her for ourselves. We have to do it ourselves because no one else is going to do it for us. Church correlation has made sure of that. While the benefits of correlation to the LDS Church are undeniable, and yeah, I know, they're trying to get away from that, but you know what? It takes a long time. And the effects have been piling up for decades. So its benefits, yeah, I mean, it made it really easy to throw that, like that simplified doctrine out there. There just wasn't much to it. So its benefits obscure its other consequences that directly affect women. Correlation limits the stories that get told in whatever form, from the institutional down to the local level, in all social settings and at all age levels. As a result, correlation enables the church to suppress group definition, perhaps even consciousness, of Heavenly Mother as a proactive deity, while it also simultaneously regulates women's access to empowering messages about themselves as potential goddesses. Thus, refusing to define Heavenly Mother institutionally, what I essentially have seen in the past, written about in the past, is a form of iconoclasm that effectively just disappears her, and you alluded to that too, is one aspect of a church-wide focus on almost exclusively male role models in story, song, and public ritual. Even until recently, even instructional lessons designed exclusively for women contain stories in which virtually all of the anecdotal images are male. So correlation attempted to eliminate anything the church determined was controversial, speculative, or extraneous, so it's not necessary for our salvation. Well, Heavenly Mother, of course, is not necessary, was defined as not necessary to our salvation. Heavenly Father is. So she's like expunged, you know, she's from the official story, so that when she gets inevitably but infrequently discussed in settings like early childhood primary lessons, her identity is carefully framed as supportive and subservient. So there's no equality in the way the church speaks about her to us. It should be clear now that the power to control all images, whether they are written, verbal, auditory, or visual, is retained by LDS men through institutionalized correlation. Pardon me. Therefore, the efforts by LDS women to reclaim and develop practices around Heavenly Mother can be seen as, in part at least, as resistance against that correlated pablum stuff. Speculation about deep doctrine gets disseminated amongst friends and acquaintances locally and in a wide range of internet discussion groups. In 1994, Armand Moss just described this really beautifully. He said, centralization, correlation, and injunctions to follow the brethren have had the effect of stultifying local creativity, and I would add intellect and aliveness, and created a generation that waits for leaders in Salt Lake to make decisions that affect everyone at the grassroots level. This local abdication of both authority and power ostensibly keeps church members safe from the consequences of uncorrelated decision-making, but many people I know, including myself, I'll admit to it, I've often had trouble making decisions because I was waiting for them to say what was so about the truth, what was real, and they hadn't provided answers to my questions. In 2006, Claudia Bushman asserted that Jan Schitt's earlier characterization of late 20th century, quote, enthusiasm for a mother in heaven among some Mormon women as a thwarted effort to develop a feminist theology is a past that their daughters are free of. that is not the case. That's nowhere near the case. In fact, a new wave of Mormon feminism is afoot, and it is a re-enchanted one that appears, and one of its main aims is the recovery and re-articulation, re-embodiment of Heavenly Mother. On blogs, internet forums, and in academic publications as well, Heavenly Mother is being debated, redefined, and claimed, or not, outside the authority structure of the church. At the same time, the church enables this, I mean, he enables it, they enable it, right? Because they refuse to incorporate her into its structure of authority. It may appear insignificant that a handful of blogs, well, it's no longer a handful of blogs, right? It's not just one or two. It's inexhaustible. It may be insignificant. You may think, oh, well, there's just these little groups of people online talking about Heavenly Mother. Well, if it were a handful of people sitting in a living room, this might be the case, but 15 blogs, or 50, or 100, or 150 have an incredible effect. It's a far-reaching effect on LDS women and men who are no longer afraid to define themselves on their own terms. Claiming Heavenly Mother as an actual being, apart from her role as an essentialist, invisible reminder of plural marriage, both historically and celestially, has dramatically empowered and changed how LDS women see themselves and their mortal and eternal possibilities, as you have very well shown. For many of them, this actively involves worshiping the Heavenly Mother while simultaneously and ongoingly exploring what it means to be a potential goddess. Well, who am I? What future am I living into? It doesn't look like that future over there. We make her visible again. We bring her back to life. However, this empowerment and enchantment has consequences, and we must develop tactics then for dealing with the impact of our seeking on church and family relationships as we determine the degree to which we are going to comply with LDS gender conventions regarding authority. Are we going to pray to Heavenly Mother? Are we going to talk about her? Are we just going to think about her? Are we going to go pagan? Are we, you know, what, join a women's circle? What are we going to do? Right? We have to be responsible for that. Though some of us keep our beliefs and feelings and activities private, others maintain close relationships with their church leaders because they report being invested in the LDS church authority. So some people go to their bishops and say, I'm praying to my Heavenly Mother, or they go there to check out, to kind of test the waters. While some of us are more demure in describing our spiritual boredom and our certainty that our knowledge is authoritative, others are much less concerned about the implication of criticizing what they say, as I just did, the mistakes they see the church making. But for me, and I'm sorry if you were here in the previous session in this room, I'm going to sound like a broken record, but what she's reminded me of, again, is the unwillingness of LDS church authorities at the highest level to proclaim doctrine. Nowhere is this more visible than in the drama that's been playing out. And it's new for me in the last couple of weeks, this drama that was playing out in Sweden, where the church sent two lower-level leaders to respond to questions of doctrine that had arisen among a very large body of saints and that essentially threatened the health and well-being of the unit there. Reading this transcript was incredibly painful for me because it is immediately clear that what the Swedish saints were asking for was confirmation of doctrine regarding their questions, and the men who had been deliberately sent there could not do that by definition. And so only a member of the Quorum of the Twelve, if I understand things right, perhaps maybe only even the prophet, can declare doctrine. They were missing in action. They're not the ones who showed up in Sweden to help put this group of Latter-day Saints back together again. And it was so painful to watch or to read. So in the case of Heavenly Mother, and it was so clear that the people who were in attendance at that fireside, or whatever they called it, were not satisfied with the answers they got. So in the case of Heavenly Mother, the church acknowledges her existence but refuses to step up and define her. Well, guess what? They may not know anything about her. They may not even want to know anything about her. But they are not going to like the result, I suspect. I may be wrong, but I suspect that they're not going to like the result of their inaction, because if they were to define her, they could bring her under some sort of they could create an acceptable place for her or way of talking about her, but because they fail to do that, we are defining her ourselves, and what we do with that, because we're doing it outside the church in pagan circles and women's circles and whatever groups that we form, Sunstone, they're not going to like what we make of that. In this way, she becomes, because she becomes whatever we want her to be, whatever we need her to be, and isn't that always the case in religion anyway? Also, the church participates, in another way, the church participates or colludes with us in these spiritual quests we have surrounding Heavenly Mother, which may lead us away from correlated doctrine. When the LDS Church released this statement explaining the religious experience of Mormonism in June 2008, it outlined the importance of individual knowledge-based and even interpretive action. Knowledge results from beliefs that are acted upon. Accordingly, Latter-day Saints test their beliefs, it says, in the crucible of experience. And experience confirms the truthfulness of those beliefs. LDS Elder David A. Bednar described the interaction between faith and knowledge. Quote, assurance, action, and evidence influence each other in an ongoing process. This helix is like a coil, and as it spirals outward, it expands and widens. These three elements of faith, assurance, action, and evidence, are not separate and discrete. Rather, they are interrelated and continuous and cycle upward. As we again turn and face forward toward an uncertain future, whatever that means, assurance leads to actions and produces evidence, which further increases assurance. End quote. So, knowing informs and motivates becoming, and becoming requires doing. So once we know something, we have to do something about it. That's what he's telling us. Indicating the centrality of personal experience in the Mormon worldview, this statement is meant to reinforce the ideology that knowing the LDS Church is true informs and motivates becoming more faithful and following institutional mandates regarding lines of prophetic authority in which doing equals following the prophet. However, this statement can actually be invoked to explain and justify transgressing the LDS ideal. In the year 2000, in his general conference talk titled Living by Scriptural Guidance, Elder Russell M. Nelson warned that while, quote, many important truths have yet to be revealed, church members should be cautious about seeking them out. Quote, preoccupation with the so-called mystery should be avoided, he said. So this contradicts the basic Mormon impulse. And so he cautions believers to, quote, be aware also of individual, of private interpretation. Look to the living prophets and official policies, not doctrines, not scriptures, but policies for interpretation. This really creates a problem for us because the church rarely declares doctrine beyond the simple basics of Joseph's visions and the church prophetic authority. And so all we have left is the handbook, the manual, right? So combine this with the extent to which the church has reduced Mormon doctrine to its lowest common denominator, and one result is a sense of separation between LDS identities, one that gets enacted at church and the other that is reserved for Sunstone and other places, other groups. Nelson also warned Mormons about maintaining this kind of alternative identity. However, he cannot avoid simultaneously authorizing that very thing when he reminds listeners that, quote, inner peace comes only as we maintain the integrity of truth in all aspects of our lives. In confirmation, another LDS.org newsroom statement asserts that, quote, Latter-day Saints embrace the acquisition of knowledge as a spiritual mandate, and that all human striving blends seamlessly into eternity. And as a result of this most basic Mormon impulse, we ongoingly seek out other venues for making meaning out of our eternal yearnings and revelatory experiences, and our need, our desire, our yearning for a Heavenly Mother.
We have about 15 more minutes. If anyone has any questions, you can come up to the mic.
Thank you. thank you both for those papers. One of the things I found really interesting in the last few weeks or a couple of months since the Ordained Women website went up, and I've been following, I don't usually follow blogs, I'm too busy, but I've been writing on this, so I've been following the blogs on the question of ordination, and I'm fascinated by how many times the Heavenly Mother comes up in conversations about ordination, that there is this. And talk about, you know, the sort of gaps that you were mentioning, Doe, that when they have no official position and people start talking, and you talked about this, Rachel, the members, I mean, we are creating theology, you know, at Sunstone. We obviously do this, right? We have for years, but also on the blogs. And I think that one of the ideas that's coming out, and it's sort of a twist, you know, rather than motherhood being the alternative to priesthood, the mother is now the priestess, right? So some almost as though her divine motherhood is her qualification for priesthood. But, and that's just one example. But I would like both of you to talk a little bit more. I think there's so much theology developing, and that there's a hunger out there, and the leaders are not filling it. So, I mean, you both talked about this, but I think it's really important, especially how it's relating now to the question of ordination.
It's not going to fit either one of you.
Thank you for that comment, Margaret, and the questions and comments. So a lot of the times when people are opposed to the idea of women receiving ordination, they usually do offer that dichotomy of saying, women have motherhood, men have priesthood. And so I appreciated that you made the distinction. Well, first, you bring before how motherhood and fatherhood are actually the pair that go together as priesthood and priestesshood. And so there were two talks earlier by this gentleman and one other woman about Heavenly Mother today that I know you were at as well. And one of the speakers there talked about this idea that we want Heavenly Mother to have the power that God has. So we either want to see her as a priesthood or a priestess, and we want to see her as acting for herself and with that power, with godly power too. We want to see her as a God. And that's the way that I envision her myself. And addressing the question of hunger, which is what a lot of my paper has to do with, is because it is personal for me that I am hungry for my Heavenly Mother, and I have this need and I feel it. And so I know a few individuals that have had really great spiritual experiences with their Heavenly Mother, and I'm not one of them. So I can't testify about that, or I can't say how close I feel to her or these other things, but I can say I want to feel close to her, and I can say that I want her to be part of my life. And one of the things that I've done in my own life is I talk about Heavenly Mother a lot, and I tell people that I'm hungry. And one thing that I found is it gives permission for other people to do the same. And I try to do this. I do it on the blog I write for Exponent, but I also do it in the church setting. And not in the ward. I just moved to New York recently, but when I was living in Los Angeles, I was a single gospel doctrine teacher in my ward. So I would set a personal goal to testify of Heavenly Mother every single Sunday. And I never received any negative feedback, but to the opposite of that, I received a lot of positive feedback. Well, where both women and men would thank me for my remarks, and they'd ask me questions, and they'd talk to me about what else they could read or what else they could learn. And so I feel like I've tried, to open up a space where we can have these conversations and where people can feel safe and feel. And I actually worked for a long time on the BYU Studies article that was co-authored by David Paulson and Martin Polito. And one of the main points, they don't obviously get everything in that one paper, but one of the points is that they wanted people to know that it's okay to talk about her, it's okay to research her, it's okay to learn about her. And it's obviously, we know that people in the past were, like yourself included, were punished for doing that. And so I think that while they know that, they're trying to create a space so we can, and so people can have that courage.
Well, what came to my mind when you asked the question was how all of these things are so intricately entwined.
You have Heavenly Mother, you have priesthood ordination, what that means, temple, what happens to us in the temple is when we put on the robes of the priesthood, we're effectively initiated into the priesthood. And then we have polygamy and what that means in relation to Heavenly Mother. And then, this is why I don't think that they'll ever, I mean, how could they possibly? I just criticize them for, right to over the coals for not being willing to articulate her. I don't want them to, I prefer it being the other way, but I know it's such a source of pain. If you're really committed to staying inside the lines, then you're waiting for Salt Lake to say something, to articulate her. But because she's so intricately entwined with all of these things, they're not going to talk about the temple and what happens to women in there. They're not going to talk about polygamy and what that means in the eternities. And they don't want to talk about her because she implies priesthood ordination for women. So why would they even try to begin to open that rat's nest up? They're not going to do it. But one thing that you pointed to, and also I don't know if I may have even forgotten what your question was. I apologize.
It's okay, I may not have been that clear.
But you've got this great body of work around images and goddess images, and I think that's also an issue, because all of these things that I listed and that you mentioned having to do with ordination, those all call forth images. And when we start to image or imagine Heavenly Mother or women in the church, what their roles are in alternate ways, in more expansive ways, then that really causes problems. And so I think in part it's because of the power of images and what those things call up for us. And so I don't know if that spoke to your question. But.
Yeah, thank you. Any other questions?
So you kind of answered my question, like when you were talking. I was interested in the article, in the BYU Studies article, and obviously the thesis of this article was that it's okay to talk about Heavenly Mother. Here are all these examples, and the response, is, well, we got excommunicated. So how does that? I saw, and when I read that response, I thought, well, what the authors are, the rhetorical purpose is not actually to state like. It's less, even though it says it's about, what the history is, it's backward looking, but it really isn't the rhetorical purpose to open up this space so that people, so I guess my first question is, did the authors, were they fairly intent on that rhetorical purpose? Like, are they kind of committed to Heavenly Mother? And then also, just out of completely random curiosity, was there some kind of general authority involvement or permission of this article?
Those are both good questions. So the first I'd say that was one of the main purposes. So I lived in Provo when I graduated from BYU in 2008 in philosophy, and then I was asked after I graduated to work on this project. So I worked for 4 months, and then I started my master's program in Boston right after. So it was first presented at the Women's Research Institute, a colloquium, in February of 2009, and at that time I was listed as a co-author, so I originally was, but then when it was going through the editing process, I was too busy to help anymore, so I was just thanked as a researcher instead. And that first paper was more interesting, I'd say, than the one that was published. But so Jack Welch at BYU Studies, the very first day, was really well received. The auditorium was full. It was publicized on BYU's homepage at their website, so it wasn't a hidden thing at the time. And it was a lot of people expressed gratitude for the speech, and so Jack Welch wanted to publish it, and so it ended up taking 2 years for that to happen. Because I haven't had other experiences with BYU Studies or even any other publishing things, I don't know if that's a normal time frame, or I don't know if that's longer than normal. And so I wasn't as involved in the second process, but talking to Martin Polito, who I'm still friends with, and his mom actually is getting a PhD at Claremont, so I have a connection with her as well. He has told me that there were at least 2 general authorities, including apostles, that were working on it, reading drafts. And so on one hand, where I wish, and I think Martin at least, and maybe even David Paulson, we all wish that we could have said more and admitted more of the messy history and admitted more of these things. I think they just felt so grateful that they could say something in this in this venue that the more average member might look at. And so even now when people say to me the thing that they all heard in primary, oh, we can't talk about her, we can't talk about her, but I can point them to this article, and where it doesn't say LDS.org, at least it's connected to BYU, which is church affiliated. And I think that that has made conversations about Heavenly Mother easier, at least for me personally, because I have a resource that I can point them to and that they can see, oh yes, look at all the prophets who talked about her. And even Spencer W. Kimball, it was 6 or 7 conference talks, I think. And so one of the things that I did is looking through all the general authorities, or all, because we wanted, I would have liked to include more things, but I think they wanted it to look authoritative for the average number. And so looking at the time frame and what years were she spoken of the most, who was the last apostle, who was the last prophet, what were they saying? And so there's a lot that we didn't say, but I think that was one of their goals, like to just open the door for anyone to say something else in a setting that wouldn't get them in trouble and that they could recognize as somewhat official. It's published in BYU Studies in 2011. I forget the exact title, but I know it starts out, A Mother There.
Is it
something
mother,
like the historical...
Oh, just A Mother There. That's right.
Yeah,
there.
So it starts A Mother There, colon, the historical something, something. I don't remember the exact title.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
You can buy it.
But if you... David, the authors are David Paulson and Martin Pulido, so that might be easier to find it, I guess.
Any other questions?
I came in a little bit late, so I missed introduction, sorry. But you spoke about how God has like a spatial nature. He can take up some time and space. He has a body. He's a unique and like one being, you know, and we can look at him like that. Do you think, and I'm sure you've thought about this, that the reason that we don't talk about Heavenly Mother, we don't think about her generally in the church, is because there's many of them? I mean, we have to acknowledge that.
Yeah, that's the connection with polygamy. Yeah.
Right. Like, in the temple, yeah. We know, like we have examples in the Quorum of the 12 Apostles of people being sealed to more than one woman. Is the possibility that we can't put a single name or a single face or a single frame or body on Heavenly Mother the reason that she isn't part of discussion in the church?
So there is an article written by a woman named Linda Wilcox, and in that article, she sort of goes through the history of how the brethren and how the church has used the doctrine of Heavenly Mother. So she points out very clearly that at different times, Heavenly Mother has been used by the church for specific purposes. And so she talked about how during the early church, that Heavenly Mother was employed a lot more, and it was precisely to propagate or to try to confirm that polygamy was the right thing to do. And so would talk specifically about more than one Heavenly Mother. So people like Orson Pratt wrote extensively on this, like saying that there is more than one. And then later when we see it, even in the family proclamation, it doesn't say, like, we are children of the Heavenly Father and Heavenly Mother. It says Heavenly Parents. So it's more generic. And so even if you do just searches on LDS.org, in 2008, when I was researching, I think it was like 6 things came up for Heavenly Mother. And if you added for Eternal Mother or tried to add a few other things, it was like 9 to 11. But if you typed Heavenly Parents, it was substantially more. So I think part of it is people feel safer using that because it's the family proclamation language, but also it's safer because it doesn't specify. And so I think that that is a tricky thing that they don't want to bring up and don't want to talk about. I think there's only one, but I don't really have any reason to think that except that I want that to be the case.
Can I also say something really quickly?
I already raised my hand. The other thing that I would say about that, and that issue came up when I was editing an issue of Sunstone about it. They wanted me to include it, and I said, oh, good grief, we haven't even established that there really truly is one, and you want me to talk about a whole goddamn bunch of them? So, one thing. The other thing is that if there are multiple Heavenly Mothers, that means that men and women are not equal for eternity, and that the church is inherently unjust and unequal, and I don't think they'll cop to that. They're trying really hard to avoid that. So either they have to, you know, if they want to come out and say, yes, there is polygamy for all eternity, then they can watch a mass exodus of women who don't want to be concubines for their entire existence.
Can I just throw this in? The title is A Mother There, a Survey of Historical Teachings About Mother in Heaven. So that's the answer to that question.
And lastly, so I guess I sort of hinted at this, but so now when they do teach about Heavenly Mother, it is more of the monogamy, like how we're saying marriage is between one man and one wife, and so I think that's how they more use the doctrine now. But it definitely is a thing a lot of people have thought about, and I think more people have heard about it. Thank you for the question.
I just wanted to say really quickly that nobody, I mean, I'm fine with the idea of multiple Heavenly Mothers, but nobody asked the question of multiple Heavenly Fathers. Like, yeah. if we're going to say, like, oh, there are these multiple Heavenly Mothers, well, fine, you know. But, like, I see nothing. For me, I mean, we have this historical practice of polygamy in which there was one man and multiple women, but I don't see any reason why there can't be multiple Heavenly Fathers or...
We're all just eternal cousins.
All right, that's time. Thank you so much.